I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome to The Connection. What can octopuses on the psychedelic drug MDMA, also known as ecstasy, teach us about sociability? That's what neuroscientist Dr. Gould Dolan wanted to find out. These creatures are asocial, loners, with a brain structure very different from ours. No cortex, no amygdala, no default mode network. And yet, on MDMA, these cephalopods wanted to hang out with each other and were kind of, quote, touchy-feely. Dolan has been doing groundbreaking work with MDMA and other psychedelics to learn how they affect the brain and could be used therapeutically. She has a particular interest in how they can unlock critical periods in brain development when it's open to learning something new and meaningful. It's a fascinating time to be studying MDMA, psilocybin, LSD, and other psychedelics. While the research is in its infancy, some of these drugs are showing potential for treating depression, anxiety, PTSD, and addiction, but there is more work to be done. Gould Dolan joins us on The Connection today to take us inside the workings of our brain, high on hallucinogens, and where she hopes her research takes us. She's a professor of neuroscience and psychology at UC Berkeley. And Gould Dolan, nice to have you with us today on The Connection.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
Nice to have you with us. Well, let me start with a really basic question. What got you interested in the therapeutic uses of psychedelics? What got you started?
Well, I went to medical school and graduate school, so I did an MD, PhD. And when I was in my last years of medical school, I was really very depressed. I felt like all we ever did was to go around and take notes on patients and catalog their traumas. And then we really didn't have anything that we could offer them. And I just felt like the whole system was very depressing and that I really needed to go back to the laboratory where I would be able to have a bigger impact if I could discover some way that we could do better for these patients. And so, you know, many, many, many years later, I finally had that opportunity when my lab started studying psychedelics. And at around the same time that we got interested in them, the remarkable clinical results were starting to come in. And we started to think, oh, maybe we can take a mechanistic approach to understand them and come up with a better explanation for why they're working for some of the disorders that have already been described and figure out if we can optimize that or use those medicines for other conditions as well.
Do you think it also helps us wrestle with some of these larger existential questions about the sort of mind-body connection or even what consciousness is? Does it take us into that world?
Yeah, so that part of the question I actually have a much longer interest in. So when I was an undergraduate at Duke University, I couldn't decide on one single major. So the university had a program where you could design your own major. And so I designed my major on comparative perspectives on the mind. And the idea was I wanted to understand consciousness or these sort of bigger problems from the perspective of neuroscience, philosophy, linguistics, art, religion, and sort of take a broad view. And so I was doing that. And one day I remember when I was in a class called Drugs, Brain, and Behavior, it was the first time I was exposed to the idea that hallucinogenic psychedelics like LSD share remarkable structural similarity to endogenous neurotransmitter in the brain, specifically serotonin.
Wow.
And the similarity between the molecular structure of these compounds and the endogenous neurotransmitters was sort of like an aha moment for me and many neuroscientists historically, that this would be a way, you know, if we could understand how psychedelics were producing this altered state of consciousness, and we could, then we would have some sort of clue towards understanding consciousness in general. And, you know, that was in the late 90s, 1990s. And at the time, you know, the drug wars were still very much in effect. It was not considered serious science to pursue those kinds of research questions. And I was at the very beginning of my career. And so, you know, I sort of tabled that fascination with psychedelics and decided that my time would be better spent sort of learning new technologies, new techniques like wholesale patch clamp electrophysiology and molecular
Yikes.
biology and
Right.
all of these
Very
other,
sciencey
things
things.
that very sciencey things that I needed to know if I wanted to become, an expert in this field and someday return to the idea that we could understand the big questions of consciousness with psychedelics.
I'm curious whether you have taken psychedelics either for your own research purposes or your own personal exploration.
I prefer not to answer that question. I consider that to be sort of, beyond what I'm willing to answer. But what I will say is that, psychedelics are fascinating molecules, and a lot of neuroscientists have tried them. A lot of non-neuroscientists have tried them, and we can get a lot of information from, people's what are called trip reports. We learn a lot from those descriptions. And honestly, when I first started working on psychedelics in my lab, the bias in the field was because psychedelics induce these profound changes that are, something like seeing God or, mystical experiences or alterations to consciousness, that really the only way to understand what they're doing is to study them in humans. And this was certainly the bias of people like Alexander Shulgin, who in many ways is thought of one of the pioneers of the modern era of psychedelics research. He was a chemist, and he synthesized and tried on himself and a group of research, friends, researchers, psychedelics, something like 230 of them. And he very much felt like this was the only way to understand what they're really doing. And I think that there's a huge amount of information and valuable information in his books where he describes these effects along with his wife, Anne Shulgin. But nevertheless, as somebody who is a basic scientist, I still felt like there has to be something that we can learn about these drugs by looking at what they're doing across brains, across evolution, and very much was of the opinion that if we could discover something like that, then we would have a real handle that would allow us to understand how they work in the brain.
Let me, this is a very non-scientific question, but I was also thinking in preparation for the show that, human beings have been using either hallucinogens for centuries or looking for a way to have this sort of out-of-body experience. I mean, it seems that that's just part of human nature to, in a sense, want to leave our conscious self.
Yeah, so before I answer that, let me just take a step backwards because you've said it a couple of times and I just want to be clear. Psychedelics are a broad umbrella category. They include, as I mentioned, hundreds of molecules characterized by Sasha Shulgin. Saul Snyder was also a prominent neuroscientist who did a lot of this kind of characterization. And included in that category are lots of different subtypes of psychedelics. So some of them are hallucinogenic psychedelics. So these are drugs like LSD, DMT, psilocybin or magic mushrooms. These are the hallucinogenic psychedelics. But other psychedelic categories also exist. So ketamine is what's known as a dissociative psychedelic. It along also PCP is a or angel dust is a dissociative psychedelic. MDMA is not a hallucinogenic or dissociative psychedelic. Instead, it's what people call an empathogenic psychedelic because it induces these prosocial feelings that are similar to having empathy. And then the fourth major sort of subcategory of psychedelics is oneirogenic psychedelics like ibogaine or salvinorin A. And these are drugs that are the oneirogenic means it's characterized by a sort of dreamlike state. And so there has been some confusion in the field and a push by some chemists to sort of restrict the definition of psychedelics to only be hallucinogenic psychedelics or serotonin 2A psychedelics. But in my view, that is a little bit putting the cart before or the horse before the whatever the saying is, right? It's just not it's not appropriate. It's not historically accurate. You know, we were using the broad term psychedelic to include ketamine, MDMA, and ibogaine well before people started, you know, trying to subclassify the classical psychedelics as, you know, only the hallucinogenic ones. And, you know, even the term hallucinogenic is not totally accurate. So, you know, these drugs don't actually induce frank hallucinations, although ketamine does a little bit. Instead, what they do is they induce illusions. And the difference between a hallucination and an illusion is that, you know, an illusion is something that exists in, let's say, your visual field, and you just interpret it differently. So you can imagine a picture of a photograph, a still photograph of a waterfall. An illusion would be to imagine that the water, or to see that the water is running, even though it's just a postcard, right? And so that's what really even the hallucinogenic psychedelics, it's really more like an illusion than a frank hallucination where you're seeing something that just isn't there.
That was the terminology thing
I just wanted to make sure we covered before we got too much further.
I understand, and I probably will stumble over these words as we go along. But let me just, and we have about 2 minutes or so before our first break here, but I'm curious, you know, let's take MDMA. How does it work on the brain? How does it interact with the neurochemicals in our brain? How does it work?
Yeah, so MDMA is a psychedelic that primarily works through the serotonin transporter, which is this molecule that essentially its normal function is to vacuum up any extra serotonin that's left over in the synapse after it's been used for synaptic transmission. And it sort of sucks it up into the cell that makes that serotonin so that it can be recycled and more serotonin can be released. What MDMA does is it sits in that binding pocket where serotonin would normally bind, and not just block it. So drugs like Prozac or these selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, they bind to the same transporter, the serotonin transporter, and they just block it. And so by blocking it, they make serotonin more available, or more of it sort of stays around in the synapse after the blockade. What MDMA does is it binds to that binding pocket and then it reverses the transporter. So instead of being a vacuum cleaner of serotonin, it's essentially like a leaf blower of serotonin. It's pushing, extruding a bunch of serotonin into the synapse. And so it produces, you know, a very intense serotonin-based synaptic effect. But it's not just serotonin. It also has a little bit of effect on the same kind of transporter for the dopamine and also the norepinephrine transporter. But most of the social stuff is through the serotonin transporter.
And I want to take that short break and just pick up on that. But this explains, I guess, the kind of cuddle feeling, the sort of pleasurable love feeling that comes from that experience. Well, we are talking about psychedelics with our guest, Dr. Gul Dolan, and she's a professor of neuroscience and psychology at UC Berkeley, has been doing some really interesting, groundbreaking research. And we've got much more to talk about after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with neuroscientist Gul Dolan, and we have been talking about psychedelics. So just taking that MDMA, the impact that it has on the brain, the release of serotonin, and this sense of connection, of love, of cuddling, that's the sort of behavior as a result of that?
Yeah, so, I mean, it does a lot of things. Serotonin is one of the oldest neurotransmitters that we have. It does all kinds of different things. And one of the things that it does is that this blast of serotonin through the MDMA mechanism is, right. is that it causes the release of oxytocin, which, you know, those of you who have had children would be familiar with. It's the hormone that's responsible for uterine contractions during birth. It's also known by some as the love hormone.
Right.
And this MDMA activation of the serotonin transporter essentially causes a massive release of oxytocin as well.
Which explains why people feel the way they do when they're on MDMA. Your work actually focuses on the impact of MDMA on what are called critical periods. Help us understand what a critical period is. And this is something that I guess all humans go through, maybe other mammals as well, as part of our development. What is that, a critical period?
Yeah, so, I mean, actually, as far as we know, all animals have critical periods, all the ones that we've tested, including humans. The first critical period was actually imprinting behavior in gray lag geese. So this is that behavior where right after hatching, a little baby bird will form a lifelong attachment to whatever is moving around in their environment. And so typically that would be their mother, but if the mother isn't there, or if there's some scientist like Conrad Lorenz who first described this, then they'll form the attachment to the scientist or whatever other moving object is nearby. But right after that 48-hour period, that closes that ability to learn that attachment. And then anything moving around is no longer a salient stimulus, and they don't form an attachment to it. So Conrad Lorenz called this very brief window of time, this 48 hours after hatching, where the animal was extremely sensitive to its environment and could learn and make a lifelong learned memory attachment. He called that a critical period. And since that first description in 1935, we have discovered, you know, dozens and dozens mm-hmm. of other critical periods. So there's critical periods for organizing the visual system, the touch system, you know, language is a critical period that most people will be familiar with. It's why it's so much harder to learn a second language as an adult, but your first language you speak, you know, easily and fluidly. And so that's because there is a critical period for language learning. And once it's closed, it's much more difficult to learn another language.
Let me just jump in here. So you're talking about childhood and child development, and I'm assuming we're talking about a brain that has some plasticity or some flexibility, that that's something unique about a young brain. And going back to the MDMA, that has a kind of impact or influence on that.
That's right. So just to kind of take a broader view to kind of clarify how important this notion of critical period is for scientists.
Sure.
Ever since their discovery, there have been something like 7,000 papers that have looked at the mechanisms that underlie critical periods, their closures. And you mentioned one of them, which is one of the mechanisms that people have focused on is metaplasticity, or the plasticity of plasticity. So this is a change across development in the ability to induce plasticity. So when you're a child, it's very easy to induce plasticity. But when you get older, it's much harder to induce plasticity. And I won't go into the molecular details of that, but just the rules essentially change over time. And so, but that's not the only thing that controls critical periods. It's one thing. The other things that control critical periods are things like inhibitory excitatory balance, things like regulation of the extracellular matrix around the synapses and the neurons. And so we've discovered all of these different mechanisms that relate to the ability to reopen critical periods. And the reason is that we've had this insight that, you know, the reason we're so terrible at curing diseases of the brain is because by the time we intervene, the relevant critical period has closed. And mm-hmm. so people have thought, oh, we can just get in there, figure out the mechanisms, and then we'll be able to reopen these critical periods. And just to give you a little historical background, When I was a graduate student at MIT, we had a little bit of a warring lab situation with another lab at Harvard, and they were sort of actively pursuing master keys for unlocking critical periods. And I was just very much skeptical. I was like, there's no way. Anything that could do that to the brain is either going to cause amnesia, or it's going to cause, the seizures in the brain, or it's going to cause the entire structural stability of the brain to fall apart. And so I was very much against the idea that, these mechanisms could be perturbed, in a way that wouldn't be damaging to the brain, and that could be clinically useful. So fast forward now 25 years, and I was quite a surprise when we discovered that all this time, while people were using psychedelics for all of these therapeutic applications, but not really realizing how it is that they were working, it turned out that it was because psychedelics seem to be these master keys for unlocking critical periods. And they do it by, changing that metaplasticity, so bringing the brain back to that childhood level of plasticity, the ability to induce plasticity just like a child. And then they also seem to be dissolving the extracellular matrix, which is, we think, one of the permissive events that allows the memories to be sort of reconfigured. So you can imagine, if you had a mosaic tile pattern and you wanted to have a different mosaic tile pattern, the first thing that you would do before you rearrange the tiles is that you would bust up all the grout between the tiles. And in some ways, the extracellular matrix, you can think of it as that grout between the tiles. You dissolve it, and now you can move the tiles around and reconfigure those memories.
Is that where the sort of idea of therapy then becomes part of treatment by using, let's say, MDMA or some of these other drugs that you sort of tap into these critical periods and voila, a kind of plasticity, a kind of openness there allows for some kind of therapeutic breakthrough. Is that the model, or at least the idea?
Well, that's certainly our idea, but it's a little bit debated, and I can get into that, but I can tell you, you sort of hit the nail on the head. The reason that I think that psychedelics are able to circumvent what I call the melty brain problem, why they're able to reopen the critical period but not cause all of those terrible, deleterious effects that I just mentioned, is because one of the features of psychedelics is that they are context dependent. The psychonauts, or the people who use psychedelics recreationally, have known for decades that the mindset and the situational setting, the so-called set and setting, neuroscientists, we call that the context, has a profound effect on not just the quality of the trip. Whether or not you have a good trip or a bad trip is very much dependent on the set and setting, but also the therapeutic effects. So we know from, dozens of clinical trials at this point, and as well as, a lot of the clinicians' reports suggest that, you have to provide the right learning environment, the right context, the right set and setting. Otherwise, the psychedelics don't work. And so, the way I sort of usually summarize that is I say, you can't take MDMA, go to a rave, and expect to cure your PTSD. You really have to pair it with the right learning. And so, this critical period explanation offers, a mechanism for why that is and how that happens. So what we think is going on is that when you give a psychedelic and you open these critical periods, you are the set and setting is governing which critical period gets open, which set of memories becomes malleable by recent activity. So another way that neuroscience talk about this context dependence is activity dependence. And we're in the process of testing a lot of these questions at the level of cellular mechanism. How does a cell know it's in the right set and setting? Those are questions that we're very much after right now. But it seems that when you get into that open state of the critical period, then whatever you learn During that window of time when the critical period stays open after the psychedelic, that's the stuff that gets locked in. That's the learning and memory that creates the durable response, as opposed to, a transient response that's directly related to the trip.
I mean, that
And this
seems,
is
and that seems like an argument to have a trained therapist there if you're going to be doing this to deal with some kind of, problem, whether it's PTSD or something else. As you say, you don't go to a rave, but you see a professional.
Yeah. So, I mean, exactly. And I would say that this is something that is a little bit hotly debated in the field because, for the last 60, 70 years, essentially, neuroscience and translational neuroscience has been operating under what I call the biochemical imbalance model of neuropsychiatric disease. We've kind of been working under the operational understanding that, if you're depressed, it's because you have a biochemical imbalance in serotonin. And if you want to fix that biochemical imbalance, you just monkey around with the serotonin transporter and you get more serotonin, and that corrects the imbalance. I think what, and that's how, people have been sort of assuming that Prozac and other SSRIs work. But those drugs are not totally working, right? They don't help everybody. What's more is that you have to take a pill a day for, in many cases, forever. And so you are essentially treating the symptoms, but not curing the root causes. You're not changing the circumstances that lead to the depression. You're just giving somebody essentially a band-aid. And because of this, people are medicalized for life, and many people who are using these drugs chronically report pretty severe side effects, including, blunted affect, not being able to really feel the range of normal human emotions, not having interest in sex. These are big deals, and probably dramatically alter, especially when we start giving them to kids and people are using them for years and years and years and years, right? So this is the problem with the biochemical imbalance
Sure,
model. It's
sure.
treating the symptoms, but not the underlying cause.
But are you saying with something like MDMA or maybe even some of these other drugs that you're changing that during that vulnerable period, I'm assuming when you're on the drug or even coming down from it, it is a vulnerable period, that you change the narrative somehow, that you can work with someone on maybe the reason why they have PTSD?
Yeah, so that we think that essentially what psychedelics are doing are challenging the biochemical imbalance model in favor of what I call the learning model. And so what they do, and these drugs, people are taking them one, two, or three times in combination with therapy. And the evidence for this is most direct, and we have the most amount of evidence for this for MDMA, but it seems to be true of all of the psychedelics. And that during that trip, during that big journey, people have what's called a cognitive reappraisal, some big insight, a big epiphany, where they gain an understanding of what is the root cause of their depression, of their trauma, of their addiction, whatever it is. They have an epiphany, and then after the trip is over, what our data shows is that the trip ends, but the critical period stays open for MDMA for at least 2 weeks after the drug effects have worn off. And it's during that 2 weeks where you're still in this vulnerable state, where you're still in this ability to rework those memories, that you do what the psychotherapists call integration. So you are integrating your insights into all of those patterns of behaviors, those learned habits. Some of them were adaptive once, but are no longer adaptive now. Patterns of thought and the way that your personality is sort of structured around an initial core belief that you now know is no longer true, right? Or you now understand is not true. And that is how these effects, after one, two, or three doses with, combined with psychotherapy, lead to durable effects lasting, in some cases that have been measured, out to 3 years, which essentially is a cure. And so this is, and it doesn't happen that way for everybody, but, this is a real challenge to the biochemical imbalance model. and suggests a way forward towards explaining why we need the therapy and what we need to do better to support people during that time when their critical period is still open and, you know, it's a window of opportunity that we don't want to squander.
As you're describing that, I'm thinking about how much resistance we often have to change, even change for the better, is that we get used to the way that we operate in the world, even if it's not serving us, but somehow it's the us we know in the world that responds to us in a very predictable kind of way. So this is kind of must be a very shocking experience to imagine, to see life so differently in such a dramatic and bold kind of way.
That's right. And a lot of people will describe the psychedelic experience the first time that they use a psychedelic as the, you know, one of the most profound experiences of their life, equating it to the birth of a child or the death of a parent. You know, they're very, very profound. And I think that that's part of the special sauce, if you will, is that they really do cause you to pause and, you know, reevaluate the world as you know it. And I think that that is a huge part of why it is that they can have these lasting effects.
How do we know, maybe there is no way of knowing, that the insight that you have is true or that the memories that you have actually happened? Is there any way to test for that, or does it even matter? If it feels true, then it's got to be true.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I wouldn't go that far. I would say that, you know, this is something that we need to be careful about, right? I think that, you know, what ends up coming up in your trip has a lot to do with what kinds of things you've been thinking about the days before the trip, which is why a lot of the psychotherapists, you know, emphasize the importance of, you know, actually having several therapy sessions before you take the medicine, in setting an intention, and then also encouraging people to sort of stay away from toxic inputs, right? Like, you want to be careful of what you're reading before and who you're exposed to before, because those things could all come into your trip. And, you know, just to make it sort of draw the analogy to childhood again,
sure,
I will say that, you know, what we expose children to, we're very careful of, right? Like, because we know that they're in that vulnerable, sensitive state. And so we protect them from being exposed to just about, you know, just any old, you know, violent film or, you know, traumatic sort of experience, because we know that we don't want them to, while they're in this sponge-like plastic state, pick up all kinds of bad or traumatic memories.
So same thing for this kind of treatment. Let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation with Dr. Gul Dolan. And she is an expert in psychedelics, also professor of neuroscience and psychology at UC Berkeley. And we have been talking about some really fascinating research related to what we are learning about psychedelics. And after this very short break, we'll be talking about the work that she has done with octopuses. Stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Our guest is neuroscientist Gul Dolan, and she is one of the country's leading psychedelic researchers. We've been talking about a lot of the work that she has been doing with MDMA, including we'll be talking now about the work that she has done with octopuses. I always thought it was octopi, but apparently it's octopuses, and I'm very happy to know how to correctly and pronounce that animal in the plural. But these are fascinating. They are, as I described in my introduction, basically based on what I learned from you. They're asocial animals. They're solitary animals. Why did you want to give them MDMA?
Yeah. So, I mean, as I sort of mentioned at the beginning of the show, when I started working on psychedelics, there was very much this idea that you can't really understand anything interesting from animals because, you know, what is a mouse seeing God look like anyway, right? And so everybody at the time was very much focused on giving MDMA or psychedelics, LSD, psilocybin to humans, and then measuring, you know, fMRI brain images. So just measuring blood flow to different brain regions and saying, oh, look, here's a change. And this is telling us something interesting and important about the mechanism of these psychedelics. But I knew that that kind of brain anatomy type of explanation just didn't sit right with me because it seemed that it wasn't diving deep enough into what the mechanism might be like. And I have all sorts of criticisms of these kinds of brain imaging studies in general, but more specifically with regard to psychedelics, I wanted to know what happens if we give MDMA to an animal that is normally asocial, that doesn't have any of the brain circuitry that we've previously implicated in the function of MDMA, do they behave the same way? And so we designed a really simple test. Actually, this test that people use to study social behavior in mice and rodents and humans, it's called the three-chambered social approach task. And basically what it is we had an aquarium. We divided it up into three chambers. And on one side, there was a toy object underneath a little flower pot. And on the other side was another toy, was a flower pot, and underneath it was an octopus. And then we had a subject octopus that we put in the middle, and we just measured how much time did they spend in each of the three chambers.
Right.
And under normal conditions, because they're asocial, the animals spent almost all of their time on the side with the toy object and as far away from the other animal as possible. But when we gave them MDMA, now they spent significantly more time on the side with the other animal. And not only did they spend more time, their body posture changed, they started engaging in play-like behaviors. And so this was very similar to the types of behavioral changes that we see when we give MDMA to rodents and also humans. And so what this told us is that those just so explanation, oh, MDMA is hitting the amygdala and making it so that you're, you know, less anxious about social interaction. You know, the amygdala doesn't matter. You know, an octopus doesn't have an amygdala. What matters is that they bind to the serotonin transporter. And because we had the genome of this octopus, we could actually test whether or not the serotonin transporter sequence was similar enough between octopuses and humans to account for this change, and it was. And so we have like a much stronger source of evidence that the molecules are what matters and that the brain anatomy is just sort of an accident of evolutionary history, a secondary mechanism that these molecular mechanisms are acting on. And this was a profound change, a profound shift in the way that we understand these drugs, because it really sort of refocused our energy on molecules rather than brain anatomy.
But what I think is so shocking, I guess, because it was so dramatic to see these asocial, maybe antisocial animals begin to hang out and kind of almost like dance with each other. You described it as this sort of touchy-feely experience. Does that help us understand the impact on human beings when they use MDMA? They have that same kind of feeling.
Yeah, so we don't know how it directly, it doesn't really directly change our interpretation of what it's doing in humans. But what it tells us is that serotonin, which, as I mentioned, is one of the oldest neurotransmitters and has been implicated in everything from temperature regulation to mood regulation to food intake. You know, it's just sort of doing a lot of different things, probably because it's so old.
Right.
Well, what this told us is that one of the oldest functions of serotonin is sociality. What it also suggests is that octopuses have the neural circuitry for social behavior, but that for some reason that we don't know yet, it is evolutionarily adaptive for them to suppress that sociality under normal conditions and be, as you say, asocial. In fact, I sometimes talk about them as the psychopaths of the ocean because you know, they are just, you know, they're capable of cognitive empathy or theory of mind-like behaviors, but not emotional empathy. So they don't, you know, so just like a psychopath, they use their ability to know what you're thinking to manipulate and control you. They're not using it in order to feel what you feel, right? So in some sense, what this tells us is that there must be some evolutionarily adaptive reason for them to choose psychopathy over all of the benefits that normally animals have around living in social groups, cooperating, collaborating, and that somehow the benefit of being, you know, these top predators who are sociopathic or psychopathic, in a sense, outweighed the benefits of those social arrangements.
Well, let me ask you about the psychopath Charles Manson, who we know had this cult following. I think they were using LSD almost every day. And of course, you know, ended up in the murder of Sharon Tate. Can we say the drug turned them into murderers, or was there some sort of synergy between that and whatever he was feeding them kind of intellectually created this horrific experience?
Yeah, so this is a great point, and I'm so glad you brought it up. You know, people sometimes ask me, oh, should we be putting psychedelics in the water? Or, you know, they seem to be doing all these positive things. And I basically say psychedelics are neutral, right? What you pair them with matters. And so this goes back to the idea of context dependence. Right. If you take a psychedelic and you pair it with psychotherapy to address your PTSD, you can have a positive PTSD recovery effect. If you pair it and go to a dance party, you know, you probably won't cure your PTSD, but you'll probably become a better dancer and you'll bond with all of your friends who you're there with. But if you take it and you spend time with Charles Manson, who is indoctrinating you into his sort of cult-like religion and telling you that if you murder people, you will achieve helter-skelter and, you know, save the world by doing so, then you can be, you know, sort of turned into a murderer. And this goes back to my point about children. Like, when a person is given psychedelics, we need to protect them as if they are in that same level of vulnerability, same susceptibility to the influences that are around them. Because if we don't, then the terrible outcome of the Charles Manson situation certainly becomes possible. And this is why it's so important not just to say, oh, okay, they're working, we don't have to understand the mechanisms. Understanding the mechanisms, understanding this critical period opening function of psychedelics really gives us insight into areas that we can better optimize, but also things that we need to be careful of when we're using these drugs.
It's such an interesting time, and I'm sure as a researcher, a very good time, because there is just much more openness to doing research on some of these psychedelics. And Secretary of HHS, RFK Jr., has been very open to studying psychedelics, unlike people under the Biden administration who kind of shut the door on MDMA for treatment for PTSD. Are you heartened that this new openness is going to lead to more research and more understanding?
Yeah, so I mean, I think that there has been, you know, this historical closed door, but the clinical results that we're seeing with psychedelics are just undeniable. And the fact is that we are right now in the middle of what I call a fentanyl crisis, a fentanyl faceplant, when we allow drug companies and, you know, the market essentially to determine what is good for people. And we have this runaway train of drug addiction, and that's destroying families, destroying lives, and destroying our communities. Similarly, we have, you know, skyrocketing rates of depression and suicidality. And psychedelics are really offering us, and so suicidality, but then also we have all of these veterans, people with coming back from wars with really bad PTSD. Suicide rates amongst veterans are much higher than amongst the general population, not to mention all the PTSD from rape and incest and all of these other horrible things. And so people are very much feeling desperate for a cure. And to me, this is the fact that psychedelics could offer that cure is a reason to be hopeful. And in my view, this is not a partisan issue. Like, depression, suicide, addiction happens in red states. It happens in blue states. And so I applaud the you know, HHS. I applaud, you know, the governors who are taking initiative on this to try and unlock some research money to look into this potential breakthrough therapy that will not only address like a major, you know, crisis in our society right now, but also potentially offer a different way forward instead of medicalizing people for life, really offering them a cure for their diseases.
I'll just say one more thing about that,
which is that when I say these kinds of things, some of the people who work for drug companies and even some of my colleagues who are, you know, academics will say, oh, well, Ghoul, you're just being, you know, head in the clouds, you know, ivory tower academic, you know, therapy's so expensive. We need to democratize psychedelics and make them available for people without therapy. And that's really the way forward.
Whoa.
And I very much push back against that idea because that's actually, I think, how we ended up in the fentanyl, you know, face plant that we're in right now. And what I would push back is to say, you know, one of the potential uses of this insight, this critical period insight, is we can potentially use this to cure, you know, enable motor recovery after a stroke. That's a clinical trial that we are hoping to get started in the next couple of weeks. When I talked to the neurologists and I said to them, you know, this is the pushback that we're getting from the psychiatrists and the pharmaceutical companies and, you know, even some academics who are wedded to this biochemical imbalance model, the neurologists sort of scoff. They're like, well, you would never tell a patient, you know, we took out your blood clot, but you know, physical therapy or occupational therapy is just too expensive, so you go on home. That would just never happen. And the reason that this language around, you know, therapy is too expensive is even acceptable is because in psychiatry, we've been living under this shadow of like, well, it's not a cure, but it's good enough for so long that people have lowered their standards around what is an acceptable end goal. And so I think that people who are pushing this idea that we need to democratize psychedelics and get rid of the therapy are essentially dinosaurs. And we need to kind of update our understanding of how these drugs work and what a cure looks like.
Let me ask you a personal question. I was reading about your grandmother and you. You grew up in Turkey, and your grandmother, No,
I grew up in Texas.
Oh, you grew up in Texas. Okay, but your family's from Turkey. Okay.
My family's from Turkey.
But your grandma kind of introduced you to the wonders, the beauty, the joys, the excitement of science. How did she do that?
Yeah. So, I mean, as I said, I grew up in Texas, and most of the swimming I did was in the neighborhood pool, which was clean and clear and, you know, chlorinated. And then I went to go visit my grandparents in Turkey, and we were swimming in the sea, the Mediterranean Sea. And looking down at the bottom of the sea, I saw all these spiny, scary looking black sea urchins. And I freaked out and I was like, no way, I'm not going in. But my grandmother was a zoologist, and so she just was not having that as an excuse. So she plucked out one of those sea urchins. She flipped it over, showed me its little tiny teeth, showed me how it uses the spines to get the food to its mouth. And she, you know, sort of really opened my eyes to, like, the wondrous weirdness of nature. And I think I was not only fascinated and super curious after that about everything in the ocean, but also it's a good lesson for how a little bit of knowledge can help you overcome, you know, a huge amount of fear. So that, I think, lesson that I learned from her, I carried it throughout the rest of my life so far. So
we're almost out of time. Would you call that a critical period then for you?
Well,
where the world opened up?
Well, my grandmother got to me definitely while my critical period was wide open. So those early childhood experiences really matter so much. And I think that this is why we're so careful about how we interact with children, why we protect them, why we want to nurture them and give them as much homework as possible while they're still in that critical period open state.
We're almost out of time here, but I just want to, you know, just talking about all the advertisement that we see on TV for drugs. in 30 seconds or less, if you began to see MDMA advertised on TV like that, what would you do?
Well, I'm hopeful that, you know, possibly with RFK in office, that we will revert back to the pre, I think this law went into effect in 1998, where we stopped advertising drugs on television. That just needs to be returned back to a state. We're the only country in the world that allows direct advertising from pharmaceutical companies to patients. And I just think that that is manipulative and unfair.
Well, we have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today on The Connection.
My pleasure. It's been fun.
It's been fun for us as well. And again, Dr. Gould Dolan, professor of neuroscience and psychology at the University of California at Berkeley. And closing things out with the Beatles, Octopus's Garden.
In an octopus's garden in the shade, he'd let us in, knows where we've been. In his octopus's garden in the shade, I'd ask my friends to come and see an octopus's garden with me. I'd like to be under the sea in an octopus's garden in the shade.